Chapter 40. Nothing in the substance of things, but the essence of things had changed. When she ceased, the auricular impressions from their previous endearments seemed to hustle away into the corner of their brains, repeating themselves as echoes from a time of supremely purblind foolishness. Claire performed the irrelevant act of stirring the fire. The intelligence had not even yet got to the bottom of him. After stirring the embers, he rose to his feet. All the force of her disclosure had imparted itself now. His face had withered. In the strenuousness of his concentration, he treadled fitfully on the floor. He could not, by any contrivance, think closely enough. That was the meaning of his vague movement. When he spoke, it was in the most inadequate, commonplace voice of the many varied tones as he had heard from him. Tess. Yes, dearest. Am I to believe this? From your manner, I am to take it as true. Oh, you cannot be out of your mind. You ought to be. Yet you are not. My wife, my Tess, nothing in you warrants such a supposition as that. I am not out of my mind, she said. And yet, he looked vacantly at her, to resume with dazed senses, why didn't you tell me before? Ah, yes, you would have told me, in a way, but I hindered you, I remember. These and other of his words were nothing but the perfunctory babble of the surface, while the depths remained paralyzed. He turned away, and bent over a chair. Tess followed him to the middle of the room where he was, and stood there staring at him with eyes that did not weep. Presently she slid down upon her knees beside his foot, and from this position she crouched in a heap. In the name of our love, forgive me, she whispered with a dry mouth. Have forgiven you for the same. And, as he did not answer, she said again, forgive me as you are forgiven. I forgive you, angel. Yes, you do. But you do not forgive me? Oh, Tess, forgiveness does not apply to the case. You were one person, now you are another. My God, how can forgiveness meet such a grotesque prestidigitation as that? He paused, contemplating this definition, then suddenly broke into horrible laughter as unnatural and ghastly as a laugh in hell. Don't. It kills me quite, that. She shrieked. Oh, have mercy upon me, have mercy. He did not answer, and, sickly white, she jumped up. Angel, what do you mean by that laugh? She cried out. Oh, you know what this is to me? He shook his head. I have been hoping, longing, praying, to make you happy. I have thought what joy it will be to do it, what an unworthy wife I shall be if I do not. That's what I have felt, Angel. I know that. I thought, Angel, that you loved me, my very self. If it is I you do love, oh, how can it be that you look and speak so? It frightens me. Having begun to love you, I love you forever in all changes, in all disgraces, because you are yourself. I ask no more. Then how can you, oh my own husband, stop loving me? I repeat, the woman I have been loving is not you. But who? Another woman in your shape. She perceived in his words the realization of her own apprehensive foreboding in former times. He looked upon her as a species of impostor, a guilty woman in the guise of an innocent one. Terror was upon her white face as she saw it. Her cheek was flaccid, and her mouth had almost the aspect of a round little hole. The horrible sense of his view of her so deadened her that she staggered, and he stepped forward, thinking she was going to fall. Sit down, he said gently. You are ill, and it is natural that you should be. She did sit down, without knowing where she was, that strained look still upon her face, and her eyes such as to make his flesh creep. I don't belong to you anymore, then, do I, Angel? She asked helplessly. He is not me, but another woman like me that he loved, he says. The image raised caused her to take pity upon herself as one who was ill-used. Her eyes filled as she regarded her position further. She turned round, and burst into a flood of self-sympathetic tears. Claire was relieved at this change, for the effect on her of what had happened was beginning to be a trouble to him only less than the woe of the disclosure itself. He waited patiently, apathetically, till the violence of her grief had worn itself out, and her rush of weeping had lessened to a catching gasp at intervals. "Angel," she said suddenly, in her natural tones, the insane, dry voice of terror having left her now. "Angel, am I too wicked for you and me to live together? I have not been able to think what we can do. I shan't ask you to let me live with you, Angel, because I have no right to. I shall not write to mother and sisters to say we be married, as I said I would do, and I shan't finish the good husuf I cut out and meant to make while we were in lodgings. Shan't you? No, I shan't do anything unless you order me to, and if you go away from me, I shall not follow ye. And if you never speak to me any more, I shall not ask why, unless you tell me I may. And if I order you to do anything, I will obey you like your wretched slave, even if it is to lie down and die. You are very good. But it strikes me that there is a want of harmony between your present mood of self-sacrifice and your past mood of self-preservation." These were the first words of antagonism. To fling elaborate sarcasms at Tess, however, was much like flinging them at a dog or cat. The charms of their subtlety passed by her unappreciated, and she only received them as inimical sounds which meant that anger ruled. She remained mute, not knowing that he was smothering his affection for her. She hardly observed that a tear descended slowly upon his cheek, a tear so large that it magnified the pores of the skin over which it rolled, like the object lens of a microscope. Meanwhile, re-illumination as to the terrible and total change that her confession had wrought in his life, in his universe, returned to him, and he tried desperately to advance among the new conditions in which he stood. Some consequent action was necessary, yet what? "Tess," he said, as gently as he could speak, "I cannot stay in this room just now. I will walk out a little way." He quietly left the room, and the two glasses of wine that he had poured out for their supper, one for her, one for him, remained on the table untasted. This was what their agape had come to. A tea, 2 or 3 hours earlier, they had, in the freakishness of affection, drunk from one cup. The closing of the door behind him, gently as it had been pulled to, roused Tess from her stupor. He was gone. She could not stay. Hastily flinging her cloak around her, she opened the door and followed, putting out the candles, as if she were never coming back. The rain was over and the night was now clear. She was soon close at his heels, for Claire walked slowly and without purpose. His form beside her light gray figure looked black, sinister, and forbidding, and she felt as sarcasm the touch of the jewels, of which as he had been momentarily so proud. Claire turned at hearing her footsteps, but his recognition of her presence seemed to make no difference to him, and he went on over the 5 yawning arches of the great bridge in front of the house. The cow and horse tracks in the road were full of water, and rain having been enough to charge them, but not enough to wash them away. Across these minute pools the reflected stars flitted in a quick transit as she passed. She would not have known they were shining overhead, if as he had not seen them there the vastest things of the universe imaged in objects so mean. The place to which they had traveled today was in the same valley as Talbothays, but some miles lower down the river, and the surroundings being open she kept easily in sight of him. Away from the house the road wound through the meads, and along these she followed Claire without any attempt to come up with him or to attract him, but with dumb and vacant fidelity. At last, however, her listless walk brought her up alongside him, and still he said nothing. The cruelty of fool's honesty is often great after enlightenment, and it was mighty in Claire now. The outdoor air had apparently taken away from him all tendency to act on impulse. She knew that he saw her without a radiation in all her bareness. That time was chanting his satiric psalmeter then, "Behold, when thy face is made bare, he that loved thee shall hate. Thy face shall be no more fair at the fall of thy faith, for thy life shall fall as a leaf, and be shed as the rain, and the veil of thine head shall be grief, and the crown shall be pain." He was still intently thinking, and her companionship had now insufficient power to break or divert this train of thought. What a weak thing her presence must have become to him. She could not help addressing Claire. What have I done? What have I done? I have not told of anything that interferes with or belies my love for you. You don't think I planned it, do you? It is in your own mind, what you are angry at, Angel. It is not in me. Oh, it is not in me, and I am not that deceitful woman you think me. H'm, well. Not deceitful, my wife, but not the same. No, not the same. But do not make me reproach you. I have sworn that I will not, and I will do everything to avoid it. But she went on pleading in her distraction, and perhaps said things that would have been better left to silence. Angel, Angel, I was a child when it happened. I knew nothing of men. You were more sinned against than sinning, that I admit. Then will you not forgive me? I do forgive you, but forgiveness is not all. And love me? To this question he did not answer. Oh, Angel, my mother says that it sometimes happens so. She knows several cases where they were worse than I, and the husband has not minded it much, has got over it at least. And yet the woman had not loved him as I do you. Don't, Tess, don't argue. Different societies, different manners. You almost make me say you are an unapprehending peasant woman, who have never been initiated into the proportions of social things. You don't know what you say. I am only a peasant by position, not by nature. She spoke with an impulse to anger, but it went as it came. So much the worse for you. I think that parson who unearthed your pedigree would have done better if he had held his tongue. I cannot help associating your decline as a family with this other fact of your want of firmness. Decrepit families imply decrepit wills, decrepit conduct. Heaven, why did you give me a handle for despising you more by informing me of your descent? Here was I thinking you a new-sprung child of nature. There were you, the belated seedling of an effete aristocracy. Lots of families are as bad as mine in that. Ready's Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.